You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our car headlights getting too bright. Sometimes, yes, and there's been a recall of some of them. Find out more about the blinding lights. First, opioid addiction, gun violence, and COVID-19 are some of the most tragic and costly public health problems facing people in Wisconsin and around the country. Our next guest has worked on the front lines of all three problems as an emergency physician in Milwaukee, and she's been working on steps to prevent those emergencies in the first place. For her work, Dr. Juliana Denier has been recognized as one of USA Today's Women of the Year. Dr. Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me today. This is quite an honor.
Before we get into some of the specific programs you've worked on, it seems like part of your approach is to say, yes, I'm an emergency room physician, but I also want to pay attention to the public health issues that are bringing people in the emergency room in the first place. What led you down that path?
I've been lucky enough to be an emergency physician for the last 26 years and have learned that when I meet people in the ER, every single patient I see in the ER pretty much is, there's a lot more happening than what has happened in the 5 minutes prior to them to come to the emergency department. So much of what shapes our patients is specifically what they've gone through in all their lives prior to coming in the doors. If somebody comes in with a stroke, a lot of that has to do with the fact that they haven't gotten their blood pressure medications filled for the last 10 years, or the fact that they've not had access to healthy foods. That's all built into why they walk through our doors in the emergency department. So it really, as emergency providers, it really is life-giving to us to be able to do things to help people not come to our emergency department.
One big reason, of course, that people end up in emergency rooms can relate to opioid overdoses these days. You've got a couple things going on there. Can you talk about what kind of outreach you've been doing for patients who come in with those overdose symptoms?
I would love to talk about it. We are looking at this as kind of a four-pronged approach to helping people with opiate use disorder. First and foremost is just decreasing stigma and talking about opiate use disorder. This is a real, real, real problem and one that is treatable. And making sure that people know this is not a moral failing. This is something that we can help with. The second thing we're really trying to do in the emergency department is decrease the number of opiate prescriptions that we're writing for, just to decrease the amount of opiates that are on that are available to people to buy or use off prescription off that they haven't been prescribed. Thirdly is harm reduction. If somebody is currently using opiates and they're not at a point where they can stop, we have a program where we give out naloxone. Naloxone is an antidote to opiates. How opiates work in the body is they work as a respiratory depressant. If you take too much of them or accidentally take a different kind of opiate than you think you're going to take, it decreases somebody's ability to breathe. And that's where the problem comes in. People stop breathing and then their heart stops. So naloxone, or you might have heard it as a term, Narcan, mm-hmm. is a medication that can be administered by somebody outside of the hospital to counteract that opiate and bring somebody back to life. It's a really magical medication. And we are giving that out, this Narcan medication to people in the ER. And we are also working on a plan to have people who come into the ER with any problems with opiates or addiction problems to have recovery coaches come and evaluate the patient. So what that is simply is, let's say somebody comes in with an overdose and we evaluate them, maybe give them naloxone, wake them up, and we can call on a recovery coach who is somebody who has had lived experience with opiate use disorder and has had training in to become a recovery coach. They respond to our emergency department and talk to the person where they are. Say, okay, what got you here? Let's talk about this. Are you ready to talk about recovery? And if you are, help them navigate that can be very confusing way to get help. And one of those ways to get help is to be started on medication. We can start that medication in the emergency department. One that we start often in our ER is buprenorphine, and it helps people with the craving for opiates, and it also helps them with the withdrawal symptoms. So those are some of the things we've been doing to really help people when they come in at their most vulnerable in the ER to help them on the road to recovery if they want to start down that road at that time.
And also, you've been looking at public health approaches to gun violence. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
With gun violence, we are giving out gun locks in the emergency department, and that can be anybody who comes up to the desk and say, "Hey," and this is at St. Joseph's Hospital, which is that hospital is in the north side of Milwaukee, and for many, many reasons, that's a part of Wisconsin that is most heavily affected by gun violence. Disproportionately that community is affected by gun violence. So we're really trying to get home safe. So anybody can walk up to the desk and say, "Hey, I would like a gun lock," and they will be given a gun lock. They can come go home and put it on a gun if they've got one in their home, to make their home safer. So that's what we're doing for gun violence.
Dr. Denier, I got to say, so you're an emergency physician. I get exhausted just thinking about doing your job. You've come out of COVID. You're doing all these kind of extra things above and beyond, and I still hear the energy and passion in your voice. How? How do you do that?
Oh, well, I work with a wonderful, wonderful group of people. From my group, emergency medicine specialists, who are about the greatest group of physicians and advanced practitioners that I could ever hope to work for. We all work this hard. So this is why it's very embarrassing that I get this honor, because we are all doing our bit. Also, I work with the best nurses in the world, the best phlebotomists. Our team is exceptional. And through COVID, which has been so tough for everyone in the whole world, we have been a family to help each other through it and to see what people are excited about and help and support them to see what they're excited about. My group, when I became interested in opiates, were like, "Hey, you're our opiate person. We will support you in this." And they gave me all the support in the world to get more involved in this. So it's really my awesome group and everybody that I work with.
Dr. Julie, before we let you go, can you leave us with a bit of inspiration if someone else is in a situation like you were, where they see a problem and want to tackle it at its root? How do you recommend they get started?
Oh, my gosh. And in the words of my mother, just do it. I am not a smart person. I am just an ER doc. And I think if you get excited about something and try to do it, I have no knowledge about grant writing, all that kind of stuff, but I got excited about it and people will follow. So just do it. And people will get excited along with you.
Thank you, Dr. Julie, and congratulations on the recognition.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too. That's Dr. Juliana Denier, physician with emergency medicine specialist. She joined us today to talk about her work fighting opioid addiction, gun violence, and COVID-19 in her work as a Milwaukee-based physician that recently got her recognized as one of USA Today's Women of the Year. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a new anthem for Wisconsin sports fans.
When the Milwaukee Bucks won their first NBA title in 50 years last year, Milwaukee hip-hop artist Romy was courtside. As a lifelong Bucks fan, the moment was not just a thrill, but inspiring. He recently talked with WPR's Jenny Peek about how that experience led to his hit song, Fear the Deer.
Growing up, Jerome Hunt got to see his dad compete against countless Milwaukee Bucks players. Hunt would watch the one-on-one basketball games go down at Milwaukee's Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center, where his dad was the recreation director.
They had this semi-pro league called the NBA Pro-Am. And so there, that was my first experience at getting around professional athletes, Bucks players. They were looking to get a good run, and I just got to be up close and personal, got to be the water boy. And that was when I pretty much fell in love with it.
He remembers the 1988 grand opening ribbon-cutting ceremony at the Bradley Center and when the Bucks selected Glenn Big Dog Robinson as the 1994 number one overall draft pick.
With the first pick in the 1994 NBA draft, the Milwaukee Bucks select Glenn Robinson from Purdue University.
Time and time again, Hunt fell in love with the Bucks.
The same sort of thing kind of happened when they drafted Giannis, and it was another, like, huge resurgence.
A resurgence that led the team to their first NBA title since 1971.
It's over. The Bucks have done it. The long wait has ended after a half century. The Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions once again.
A victory that Hunt, who goes by the stage name Romy, is still basking in.
It meant everything, every kind of valley and peak of the team. You know, I felt like the sixth man. I was just right there, just being inspired by the team.
Bringing home the championship sent a spark of creativity through Romy, a veteran Milwaukee hip-hop artist. Standing courtside after the win, the lyrics to his hit song, Fear the Deer, unraveled before his eyes.
Do it for the city, yeah. Do it for the haters. Do it like Kareem before he went to be a Laker. Yes. 50 years later.
I just went into grind mode, just full, like, I need to capture this. This inspiration and this type of me coming to all these Bucks games since I was a kid and all this culminating into this moment, I had to capture that. And Fear the Deer is that.
Fear the deer, fear the deer. We the Bucks, we the champs, this our year.
Some of Romy's favorite lyrics in the song look to the future instead of just reflecting on last year's glory.
I like the repeat is our move. Greek freak is that dude.
And like you said in that interview, we can't play with our food. We gon' ride or die for our team, whether we win or whether we lose. I be in the front row, lit like Bakhtiari chugging them brews, man.
I like that because repeat is our mood. And so I wanted to put it in there just to kind of just put it on people's mentals that we have some more winning to do.
Fear the deer, fear the deer, in the deer district, and we chugging beers.
And he's feeling pretty good about the Bucks' chances this season.
We go as far as Giannis, K-Mid, and Drew takes us. And just getting Splash Mountain finally back. Just seeing Brooke Lopez out there to finish the season up to really get back in shape just in time for the playoffs. That was a much-needed addition. We're the champs until somebody beats us. And so that's going to be the mood. That's going to be the mentality.
And Romy will have the chance to deliver that energy on the court at halftime during the Bucks' final home game of the season on April 7th.
When you love music as much as I do, that joy and that passion and that love, when it's reciprocated from the fans and from the listeners, that never gets old.
Would you rip that rock? Started up the fast break. Break. 120 on the clock.
WPR's Jenny Peake brought us that story on Milwaukee artist Romy and his new song, Fear the Deer. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum, Bucks in Six.
Coming up, Fear the Glare. The headlights in our cars have been getting brighter, but they could be getting smarter, too. We'll find out how better headlight design could help prevent accidental collisions and deaths. That's next year on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Do you ever feel like the headlights on some cars are too bright, even dangerously bright? GM recently recalled headlights from certain years of its GMC Terrain SUV. Turns out the problem wasn't the brightness exactly, but a glitch that would cause the light to point in the wrongish direction. But are those GM headlights and other modern car lights actually too bright? Is anything being done about that? These are questions that intrigued Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate, and inspired a recent piece he wrote there. Henry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when you first saw the news about this big GM headlight recall, what was your first response?
Oh, I felt vindicated because I have been writing and complaining about the bright headlight crisis for years now. When I drive sometimes, and I drive at night, I'll sometimes adjust my rearview mirror so that I don't have the lights of the person directly behind me shining right in the mirror, because I feel like it makes it hard for me to see in front of the car. And so I have long had a suspicion that headlights are in fact getting brighter. And when I heard about this recall, I thought, oh, they're finally going to deal with the problem.
But not exactly, it sounds like.
No, unfortunately not. The issue with these GMC Terrain headlights is apparently that they, because of the way the reflectors work inside the casing, they shine up and out at a 45 degree angle up. So they might blind like a bird in a nest on the side of the road up in a tree. But they are not responsible for me or for any of your listeners feeling like headlights are particularly bright on the road at night.
Now, I'll admit, Henry, I thought it was just me. Like, maybe this is part of the aging process or something. I don't know. Have headlights changed in some ways that's making them either actually brighter or feel brighter?
Yes. As it turns out, there is a reason that you might feel that there is a lighthouse behind you on the road at night, or in front of you, for that matter, if you're on a two-lane road. And there's a couple things going on. So I talked to some people who study headlights, and I heard three things. I mean, the first of them, which is probably the most important, is that cars are getting bigger and they're getting higher. And so the more SUVs and pickups are on the road, the higher the headlights, and they're supposed to point down. But the other thing that happens is that over time, headlights get bumped out of place, and many state inspections don't even address the question of where the headlight is pointing. So you combine the higher cars and the headlights out of position, and you're liable to get headlights that point right into your eyes on the road at night. So those are two of the problems going on.
Now, but is the intensity of the light getting more, whatever it is?
Well, that's the third thing, right, is that the quality of the light has changed. There used to be halogen lights, then there were high-intensity discharge lights, and now there's LED lights. And LED lights really are brighter, there's a reason that they've become so popular. If you buy a new car today, you're probably going to end up with LED headlights. One of the reasons they're popular is because they're brighter. And so drivers who drive with them feel like they're getting better visibility of the things around them. And they are. And they feel safer. What is happening to the people who are outside their car has not really been the concern of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Let's bring on a caller. Zeke is with us in Bowler. Zeke, hi.
Hello. I'm only 39. I have no vision problems, but it's impossible to drive at night with these bright lights when roads are wet. I've had three close calls, one which took the left mirror off my truck.
Wow.
Because I can't see where I'm driving.
And is this oncoming bright lights from the other direction of traffic, Zeke, or lights behind you in your rearview mirror?
Oncoming traffic.
Okay.
Two-lane roads are bad. Four-lane roads aren't much better. But the people don't even know how to turn the brights off. You flash them, and they just totally ignore you.
Zeke, thanks for the call. Now, Zeke's worried those brights might be on. Could it even be those normal headlights as they're made nowadays that could be blinding us, Henry?
I mean, I would never assume that lots of people do sometimes leave their brights on because they're just not paying attention to what's going on, right? But I do think that the other thing that might be happening is you may be looking at headlights that have been bumped out of place. You know, most cars on the road, they get their bumps and scratches, and after a while, the lights may get out of position. And one of the guys I talked to did a study of this, and he went around a mall parking lot at night and staring. I guess I don't know if he's blind now or what, but he stared into all these cars' headlights and tried to measure how many headlights were out of position and how many were pointing up when they should have been pointing down. And he found that 2/3 of cars have at least one headlight that's somewhat out of position. So that's sort of endemic. And like I said, a lot of state inspections don't even deal with that problem.
Now, thanks for that call, Zeke. You wrote, Henry, that Europe is working on these, using these adaptive driving beams. We might see them here in the U.S. What are those?
Yeah. So this is cool. LEDs, I think, have brought some of us the pain of staring at these like super cool, really blue lights. But the other thing that they're going to produce is this technology that they have in Europe and in Japan. It's called adaptive driving beam headlights. And as part of the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the Congress is requiring NHTSA to approve these headlights by 2023. So we're going to see these on American roads in the next couple of years. And what they do is they actually sense the arrival of an oncoming driver and redirect the light away from the oncoming car. So it'll sort of be like you have your brights on the whole time with respect to the things that you can see, the road ahead, the landscape around you. But they're actually designed to make sure that the people who are driving in the opposite direction don't get your headlights right in their eyes.
Do we know, Henry, if there are statistics about safety issues with these two bright lights? Do we know that they're implicated in crashes?
You know, I haven't seen any statistics about this. We know that the roads are getting more dangerous, right? That there were more fatal, certainly pedestrian fatalities are at a, I think, an all-time high and are up 50% in the last decade or so. And during the pandemic, obviously, there was a lot of crazy driving and fatalities increased even as the total amount of driving we were doing went down. But I have not heard headlights cited as one of the reasons that that's happening. I think it's for most of us, it's primarily an annoyance, although I can't say for sure.
And just in our last few moments, Henry, you mentioned, you know, those bright lights. If I'm driving the car with the bright lights, that makes me safer. Forget about the rest of you. You've complained about that. Other safety experts have complained about this in the past, not looking at the safety of the people outside this particular vehicle.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's a point where even the adaptive driving beam headlights, right, they're not gonna shine any less brightly for a pedestrian on the side of the road. So if you're somebody who's feeling the glare of the bright headlights because you're walking around or you're riding a bike, those headlights are gonna shine on you even brighter than before because they are trying to help the driver see you. And when I talked to somebody about this, I said, well, that sounds like a very painful experience for those of us who have to walk around some of these F-150s. And he said, well, better blind than dead.
Henry, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate. We talked to them today about car headlights and why they seem to be getting brighter. You can read more from Henry at Slate.com. Share your thoughts with us on bright headlights. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, amid some worrisome economic news, a Wisconsin economist makes the case that the U.S. has a strong and prosperous economy going on right now. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a lot of people try to live their lives with no regrets. But is that a good thing? Is it even possible? An author makes the case for understanding and learning from our regrets to help us move forward. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn about efforts to lower gas prices in the U.S. and how well they might work. First, you've probably racked up at least a few regrets in your life. They might be small things, like wishing you left earlier when you're running late for something. Or they could be bigger things, like wishing you had the courage to ask someone out or that you chose a different career. Our next guest says those regrets are a core part of what makes us human. He says if we understand regret better, we can actually use it to our advantage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Hey, if you're willing to share, do you have a regret that's been hard for you to let go of, or have you been able to take a regret and learn from it for the next time? Have you learned things from your regrets over time? How have they changed the way you act now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Pink is a New York Times bestselling author. His latest book is The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, you lay this out right off the bat in your book. A lot of people love the concept of no regrets. Some of us even get it tattooed on ourselves. Why does this no regret idea become so widespread?
Well, I think it's because we're a little bit over-indexed on positivity. We think that we need to be positive all the time. We think that we should be looking forward all the time, that we should never look back, that when we experience a negative emotion, particularly a negative emotion like regret, we should brush it off, think positive, and move on. And the trouble with that philosophy, that no regrets philosophy, is that it runs against 50 years of science, and it's a terrible blueprint for living.
Why? Why is that a terrible blueprint for living?
Well, because regrets serve a function. Here's the thing. Regret is one of our most ubiquitous emotions. It is one of the most common emotions human beings have. It's arguably the most common negative emotion human beings have. There's 50 years of evidence showing that the only people who truly don't have regrets, right, who actually are true to this no regrets philosophy are five-year-olds because their brains haven't developed enough, people with certain kinds of brain lesions and neurodegenerative disorders, and sociopaths. The rest of us have regrets. And, you know, I don't like experiencing regret. Nobody does. So there's this puzzle about why is something so unpleasant, so widespread? And the reason is it's useful if we treat it right. And the problem is we haven't been taught how to treat it right. We think of it as something to ignore. When we can't ignore our regrets, we end up wallowing them. What we should be doing is confronting our regrets, thinking about them, using them as engines of progress.
All right. How do we do that? I look back at some of my life. I regret A, I probably don't want to think about it. As you say, B, if I start thinking about it, I wallow in it. How do I steer that better course?
We have a lot of evidence on how to do that more effectively. It begins with how we think about ourselves and our regret. When we talk to ourselves in the face of missteps and screw-ups, we are brutal. Our self-talk is vicious and cruel, and the solution to that is stop doing that. Instead, practice something called self-compassion. Self-compassion is treating yourself with kindness rather than contempt, recognizing that your regrets are part of the human condition. You're actually not that special. If you have a regret about kindness or lack of boldness, it's very, very common. And also our mistakes are a moment in time, not the full measure of our life. And so once we treat ourselves with self-compassion, we can begin to talk about our regret, make sense of our regret, and systematically extract a lesson from it that we can apply next time.
Talking to Daniel Pink about his new book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that you regret and that you're willing to share? Do you feel like you wallow in it? Do you try to forget about it? Or have you learned from it? Do you have questions for our guest about this, the science of regret? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, you've done these massive surveys, first in the United States, then a worldwide one looking at regret. What are some of the most common big regrets that people express in these surveys?
Well, what I found and actually look at, so thank you for mentioning that. So I did one big giant public opinion poll of the U.S. population that showed that when you look at sort of the main areas of people's lives, people regret a lot of different kinds of stuff. They have regrets about careers. They have regrets about education. They have regrets about health. But then I also did something called the World Regret Survey, where I just collected regrets a lot. We now have over 20,000 regrets from people in 109 countries. And what I found there, when you actually go beyond the domains of life, and I read through the first 15,000 of these, is that around the world, over and over again, people seem to share the same four regrets. Over and over again, they express the same four regrets. They have less to do with the part of life you're in, career, education, whatever, and more to do with, I think, some fundamental human longings and aspirations.
What are those main longings and aspirations that that will lead us into this path of regret?
Well, I'll go through them very quickly. Foundation regrets. Foundation regrets are, if only I'd done the work. These are people who have regrets about saving too little, spending too much, about not taking care of their health, about not working hard enough in school. Again, small decisions early that add up to calamitous consequences later. Second category, boldness regrets. Boldness regrets are, if only I'd taken the chance. Again, this spans the domains of life. You mentioned one at the top of the show, Rob. Well, a lot of people regret not asking somebody out on a date. But these are people who regret not traveling, people who regret not starting a business, people who regret not speaking up. They're at a moment in their life when they can play it safe or take the chance. They don't take the chance, not always, but often they regret it. Third category, moral regrets. If only I'd done the right thing. These are regrets about bullying, marital infidelity, other kinds of transgressions. And finally, the fourth category, connection regrets. If only I'd reached out. They're relationships, it's regrets about relationships that have come apart or should have been intact or were intact and are no longer intact. And somebody wants to reach out, but they say it's going to be awkward. The other side's not going to care. And so they don't do it and it drifts apart further. And with remarkable regularity, people express these same four regrets.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in Appleton. Jake, hello.
I had a question. what can we do, or what are some mechanisms when we find ourselves loathing, maybe in some of these regretful type thoughts? Any help for our viewers or listeners, rather? Thanks.
Sure. Sure, Jake. So as I was mentioning earlier, one of the best things you can do is to stop. The first thing is to stop that march toward rumination. And the way to do that is to treat yourself with the same generosity and kindness and empathy you would treat somebody else. If a friend of you came to you and said, "Oh, Jake, I made this mistake," you typically wouldn't say, "You idiot, what's wrong with you? You're the worst person in the world." But that's how we talk to ourselves. And as I said before, don't do that. Treat yourself with kindness. Recognize that these mistakes, these regrets are part of the human condition. The second thing you can do, and it's really important, is to talk about it or write about the regret. When we talk about a regret or write about it, we unburden ourselves. What's more, we do something profoundly important for negative emotions. We take this abstraction, this blobby negative feeling, convert it to words, and then that's far less fearsome. These concrete words are less fearsome than the abstract emotion. And finally, we have to draw a lesson from it. We have to be explicitly draw a lesson from it. And a good way to do that is to get some remove from it and ask yourself, what would I tell my best friend to do in this situation? Or what would I want to have done 10 years from now? And so when we reframe inward and treat ourselves with kindness, when we express outward and make sense of it, and then when we move forward by drawing a lesson from it, we can begin to develop the habit of using our regrets as an engine for progress. And when we do that, there is a massive amount of evidence that it helps us in profoundly important ways. I mean, even in more reductively narrow ways, it helps us become better negotiators. It helps us become better problem solvers. It helps us become better parents. The problem is no one has taught us how to do that. And it's a very simple process.
Thanks for that question, Jake. We're talking to author Daniel Pink. His new book is called The Power of Regret: How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to live your life with no regrets? How is that working for you? Or have you made a point of learning from regrets, things that you see as mistakes in your past and trying to get it better the next time around? Or do you have questions about how all this regret stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with author Daniel Pink about his latest book, The Power of Regret: How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You could join in to share regrets you've had, how you've overcome them or dealt with them, or your questions about regret. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joel on Facebook writes, "We cannot change the past, but we can certainly learn from it. Holding on to regrets or resentments destroys our ability to enjoy today." What do you think? Share your thoughts. Dan, something that struck me in your book, you share a lot of regrets that people shared in your surveys. One story that really stuck with me when it comes to Joel's comment about learning from our regrets, a woman who talked about regretting that she hadn't listened to her grandparents more, enjoyed time spent with them until it was too late, they'd passed away. She took that, though, and said, "Okay, as my parents age, I'm going to make sure to listen, and I'm going to make sure to take that time." Can you talk about that as an example of how we can use our regret?
Sure. It's a great story. This is a woman named Abby who lives in Phoenix, Arizona. And when she was growing up, her grandparents, who lived in Indiana, would come and visit for a couple of months a year because Arizona winters are far more pleasant than Indiana winters. And when she was a kid, she hated it. She resented them being there. And then they passed away and she realized she had screwed up. And what she missed was the connection, the stories. And what she decided to do is, again, this is a great example. She could ignore it, say, "No regrets, no regrets. Look positive, be positive, look forward," right? Or she could say, "Oh my God, I'm a horrible human being. This is the worst thing that anybody's ever done." Instead, she said, "Oh, I feel bad. That negative feeling is a signal. It's a signal about what I value, and it's a signal about what I should do next." And so she has begun systematically collecting the stories of her parents, who I think are in their early 70s at this point, making an effort to to literally to collect their stories and assemble their stories. And so she has that sense of meaning. She has that sense of purpose. And it's a good example of the best way to deal with regrets, which is to use them as information, as data, as signals.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Adams. Randy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Randy?
Well, I just think another word for regret is forgiveness. You have to learn to forgive yourself, because most people that have regrets, it's because it's their something that they have done and that they should have done. And if they learn to forgive themselves, they can work towards, like, say you said something bad to a friend or something and you regret it, and then it just eats at you and eats at you. You got to forgive yourself for saying it, and then maybe you can go to your friend and apologize.
Randy, thanks a lot for sharing that. Dan, what do you think about the forgiveness part of this?
I think Randy makes a great point. I mean, what she is calling forgiveness is an aspect of self-compassion, which is, you know, treat yourself as generously as you would treat somebody else. You know, the other thing that she that Randy mentions is a pretty interesting distinction in the architecture of regret, which is regrets of action and regrets of inaction. Regrets about something that I did and regrets about something that I didn't do. So for things like, let's say you said something terrible to your friend, to use Randy's example, that's a regret of action. You can actually sometimes make repairs on those. You can apologize. You can make amends. You can make restitution. What's interesting is that what lives with people far longer than regrets of action are regrets of inaction. As we age, regrets of inaction, regrets about what we didn't do, outnumber regrets of action by about 2-1.
Randy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Pink about his book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your stories, your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dan, a thing that really strikes me here is a lot of the regrets, not all of them, but a lot of them are kind of, we become science fiction authors and craft the alternate history. What if I had gone to school or hadn't gone to school or married this person instead of that person or whatever, and our alternate history is way better than the one we're really living? How do we get over that one?
Well, it's an interesting question, because sometimes our alternate history is way better than the one we're living in now. But I think what really eats at people is not knowing what that alternate history was, and also not delivering at the moment. So, for instance, I have a lot of people who regret not asking, as we talked earlier, not asking somebody out on a date or something like that. But very few of them say, oh, if I had asked him out on a date, we would be married and have 3 kids and, you know, living, a beautiful life in Milwaukee. They're not saying that. What's gnawing at them is, in that particular case, is not stepping up at the moment of being at a juncture in their lives and having a chance to do something bold and shrinking from that chance. Now, you're right that the way we think about regret is to conjure these alternative histories. But what seems to bug people about a lot of these inaction regrets is not so much the outcome, but the decision itself.
Now, one thing about your 4 main buckets of regret, the foundation one, where I wish I'd taken better care of myself, planned for my financial future, and so on, it seems sometimes to contrast with the boldness one. I wish I'd taken that chance. I wish I'd done this thing on the spur of the moment. How do we reconcile those two? The I wish I'd taken more risks versus I wish I'd hedged my bets better.
Yeah, that's a good question. The things that people did, I actually think there's actually a very close affinity between having a stable foundation and having a psychologically rich life. I think that having a stable foundation allows you to take sensible choices. The foundation regrets that people were talking about were not, you know, when they spent money, they were spending money on frivolities. They weren't saying, oh, I tried to start a business and it failed, and therefore I'm in bad financial shape. I don't think I had anybody who said that. I had people who said, I earned an okay income, but I spent it going out to restaurants and buying cars and stuff that I didn't need. So the foundation regrets were very rarely a trade-off with boldness. They were something different. They were about kind of investments in oneself. And so people were not, it's not like people were being overly risky in compromising their foundation. They were being actually stupid in many cases. And when you have at least a stable foundation, that gives you a little bit more of the temerity to take that trip, to try something more more adventurous.
We heard from Dean on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, regrets equal fear of the past, worry equals fear of the future. Mm. Live in the now, Dean concludes. Easier said than done for me, Dan. I don't know. Is that normal?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not terrible advice, but I think that one of the things that you see in some of the research on the temporal side of human development and human flourishing is that what we want is in some ways an integration of the past, present, and future. What we want is we want the past to inform our present, and we want the present to guide our future. There is a very interesting personality psychologist at Northwestern University in fairly nearby Evanston, Illinois, and he says that people see their lives in terms of narratives, and there are two kinds of narratives that he says. Dan McAdams is the guy's name. He says there are contamination narratives where things go from good to bad, and there are redemption narratives where things go from bad to good. And humans seem to flourish when they see their lives as redemption narratives. And the downside of living in the present only is that it's not a narrative. It is simply, you know, processing this particular moment and not seeing how it integrates into one's past, present, and future. And we know healthy flourishing depends, at least in part, on seeing your life in this narrative terms of making progress, of getting better, of moving from bad to good.
Dan, you talk at the end of your book about, you know, this isn't just research you've done for research's sake. It has started to seep into your life. How has your long look at regret changed your own personal behavior?
Well, on these connection regrets, I have to say it's changed it significantly. So what happens with these connection regrets is that people have these relationships, often friendships, usually not. I'm not talking about romantic relationships mostly. Think about a friendship, and the friendship comes apart. And usually they come apart in profoundly undramatic ways. They drift apart. And one side wants to reach out and they say, nope, it's going to be awkward if I reach out, and the other side's not going to care. So it drifts apart more and it feels more awkward, and they think the other side's not going to care less. And they're wrong. There's a pile of evidence showing that that reaching out is far less awkward than you think, and the other side almost always welcomes it. And so for me, it's like if I'm at a juncture where I'm saying, should I reach out or should I not reach out? Being at that juncture has answered my question. I mean, always, you know, reach out. If you're at that juncture, reach out. And that's changed me, because I'm not somebody who is like super social or super, you know, really good at reaching out. But this changed my view on it, because I had those misguided views of awkwardness and the suspicion that the other side wouldn't care. And I was flatly wrong.
Well, now, apart from reaching out, Dan, in our last minute or so, leave us with a bit of advice on how to start using regret in a happier way.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would suggest with people is this. This week, have a conversation with someone about your regret. People want to talk about this. Tell somebody around a dinner table, in your office, hey, here's a regret that I have. Here's what I've learned from it. And here's what I'm going to do about it going forward. That simple process. Here's my regret. Here's what I learned. Here's what I'm going to do about it. That will trigger one of the richer conversations that you will have this year. I can almost guarantee it. It's a topic people want to talk about. It's a topic that we've made taboo, but it's a topic that can yield very powerful lessons in what we value and how we should lead a meaningful life.
Dan, thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Pink. He's the author of a bunch of books. He was with us today to talk about his latest. It's called The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can find a link to information about the book at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you have thoughts on regret, maybe an experience to share yourself, there's still time. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.